All right, welcome everybody. This week's Parsha, Parsha Vayeshev. The title of the shiur is Forcing It. We have, just to give you intro, we're going to get into the Parsha. We, of course, have Yaakov, and who are now living in, they're living in Canaan. They have all their 12, his 12 children. And we begin the stories of Yosef and the brothers, which will span the rest of the four parshiot, the four parshiot of the book of Bereishit. So with further ado, I elected to go for another office clip, because the office is a series that just keeps on giving, and the clip is called "What's Up, Dog." So here we go. So let's go to the videotape.
Okay. Nothing much. What's up with you?
I cannot believe I fell for that. Oh my gosh.
What? What? Where's the funny? Give it to me.
Is it me, or does it smell like Up Dog in here?
What's Up Dog?
Nothing much. What's up with you?
Oh, wow. I walked right into that. Oh, that's brilliant. Hey, Stanley, is that jacket made of Up Dog?
I'm on the phone.
Mm. What flavor coffee is that? Up Dog?
What's that?
I don't know. Nothing. What's up with you?
Huh?
No.
What does that mean?
What does what mean?
The thing you just said.
Just forget it. Dwight! Hey, is it me, or does this place smell like Up Dog?
What's Up Dog?
Gotcha! Oh, God. Crap. Nothing. How are you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
All right. All right. So why is Michael going around the office telling this lame joke?
Because he wants to seem like the funny guy, you know, wants to get laughs.
Exactly. And and why is he not being successful?
Because he's not naturally funny. He's like, I think he's trying too hard.
Trying too hard. And what's the problem in the, what's the problem with his delivery over here?
He's not being himself. He's not being, like, you know, casual and his natural self. He's trying to, like, force it.
Right. And also, he's not preparing people. He's just trying to, like, just say...
he's trying to skip to the punchline. Right.
Right. Does it smell like Up Dog here? Hoping for the guy to say, oh, what's Up Dog? Oh, then you can say, everything's fine. You know, that's the joke you're trying to get. But he fails repeatedly. So to go a little deeper... is what self-image causes Michael to keep on telling the joke to yet another person, even after he has failed multiple times?
Attention seeker.
He wants to have attention. Okay, that's true. But why? But why? But again, so but he's already failed. So it's not a good tool of getting. It's not a good tool of getting attention. I mean,
but he can't see that. He's just trying to, like, get that one laugh, and then when he gets it, he starts laughing and he loses his kind, you know, his train of thought.
Now, this was the kind of joke that he was. As remember, the joke was not just a regular joke, but he was caught. He fell into it, as he said before. So he got, you know, he fell into the joke. He was, quote unquote, you know, made fun of. Like, you know, he said, oh, what's up? What's up, dog? What's up, dog? And he said, fine, thank you. You know, whatever. So he was already victimized. So he feels he has to, like, you know, get himself restored by he's telling the joke to somebody else and somebody else falls for it. He doesn't want to be the only idiot that falls for the lame gotcha joke. You know what I'm saying? So he goes around the office trying to say the joke. Of course, it falls flat every single time. He doesn't prepare people for a joke. They're just like, you're just being weird. What are you talking about? It's like, it's being met with absolute, you know, mystery. What are you doing? So as Scott pointed out, he's trying to force it. Now, what are the four elements? We can break it down further of the emotional world of why he is forcing it. What is the first step psychologically? What does the person, Michael Scott, what is the first ingredient of the person, well, in this case, Michael Scott, forcing it? What do you have to start with?
Need for approval.
What was prior to that?
Narcissism.
Low self-esteem?
Right. You know, low self-esteem or immature self-image. There's some very basic psychological, which could, of course, stem from a narcissism. He starts off with a very immature or very needy self-image. Step one. Okay? Step two, what happens? Now his image is what? What is his immature self-image?
He's super funny.
He is the most funniest guy in the office. Right? He is the most clever guy in the office. Okay? He shows up to work. What happens?
Everyone thinks he's lame.
Well, he walks into the joke. He didn't catch it. He didn't realize. So he's no longer the clever person. He is not the joke teller. He is the butt of the joke. So now then what's the next step?
Redemption.
He has to get redemption. So he's got to tell the joke to other people. So they all fall for it. And then he becomes the clever one. He becomes the clever, funny one. Okay, what happens? So he tries with the first person. What happens?
Failure.
He happens with the second person.
Failure.
So why does he keep on going?
To vindicate himself.
Exactly. His sense, in order to restore his sense of self, he must gain validation, approval, a win, a success, and every single time it's literally digging himself deeper into his grave. Not only is he not the clever one or the funny one, he gets progressively becomes the annoying, not funny one. And instead of people lauding him as being great, they just look at him as being an irritant. As the other guy says, "I'm on the phone." I mean, he's just like getting on people's nerves. And of course, the essence of the office, as we discussed a couple of times, is his tremendous low self-awareness, which of course allows us to laugh along with him or at him. Okay, so we're going to get to now this with this introduction, we can have a better appreciation of what happens with the story of Yosef. Shana, Bavakasha, take us in here.
Meanwhile, Yaakov settled in the area where his father had lived in the land of Canaan. These are the chronicles of Yaakov. Yosef was 17 years old. As a lad, he would tend the sheep with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. Yosef brought his father a bad report about them. Israel loved Yosef more than any of his other sons, since he was the child of his old age. He made Yosef a long, colorful coat. When his brothers realized that their father loved him more than all the rest, they began to hate him. They could not say a peaceful word to him. Then Yosef had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. Listen to the dream I had, he said to them. We were binding sheaves in the field when my sheaf suddenly stood up erect. Your sheaves formed a circle around my sheaf and bowed down to it. Do you want to be our king? Retorted the brothers. Do you intend to rule over us? Because of his dreams and words, they hated him even more. He had another dream and told it to his brothers. I just had another dream, he said. The sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me. When he told it to his father and brothers, his father scolded him and said, what kind of dream did you have? Do you want me, your mother, and your brothers to come and prostrate ourselves on the ground to you? His brothers became very jealous of him, but his father suspended judgment.
Okay. All right. So this is the story, of course, of Yosef, the favoritism, the he's given the coat because his father loves him more. And then we have the two dreams, of the sheaves. His sheave stands up and all the sheaves bow down around him and your sheaves bow down to it, which of course they interpret as being, oh, do you want to be our king? It's a veiled sense of you want us to coordinate you as being the leader. And of course, what was the reaction of the brothers? What emotion came out after the him telling them the first?
It was definitely not a good one.
Hatred.
There were hatred and jealousy and.
No. First one was hatred, and then when he had the second dream of that, now the sun, the moon.
Well, when did you get the coat?
Then what's the feeling then?
Jealousy.
Okay, so that's another question. In other words, why hatred? Then jealousy. Okay, it seems to be that the jealousy is worse. Okay, so we have to get into that.
All right. Is the right translation that in the verse 1, it says Yaakov, and in verse 3, changed his name to Yisrael? And if so, that is there a reason for that?
That's what the Pasuk says. That's a good question. Again, the Torah goes back and forth by calling him Yisrael and Yaakov. That was brought up last week. That same question, Rabbi Fox. It's a good question. You have to study it each time. Why it would be one versus the other? That's a good question. I don't know. I don't have an answer off the bat. Now, of course, we have to have a couple of Rashis. Okay, so Julie Bivakasha, Rashi.
And he being a lad, his actions were childish. He dressed his hair and touched up his eyes so that he should appear good looking.
Rashi says, and he being a lad, let me just go back to the pasuk. There's an important Rashi is always responding to a textual question. Look at this pasuk over here, this verse. What is textually strange that would bring in the midrash? There's a textual problem that Rashi is trying to solve.
It says Yosef was 17, but then it says in the next sentence as a lad, which makes you think he's like a little kid, like under 10 years old.
All right, so the Hebrew is v'hu na'ar. Well, obviously, if the Torah says he's 17, we know he's a Na'ar. So why are you telling him, why are they getting both identifications? So therefore, Rashi's answer, his actions were childish. He dressed his hair, he touched up his eyes, they should appear good looking. What is Vahu Na'ar? How is, quoting the Midrash, how is Rashi learning Vahu Na'ar? And he's a young youth, if you will. What is that really teaching us? The repetition of the additional identification is teaching us what? The Vahu Na'ar is not sharing us where is he in the growth of from baby to old person. What stage is he in his physical growth? What really is the Vahu Na'ar, as understood by Rashi, teaching us?
His maturity.
Exactly. In other words, he's 17 years old, But you should know who Nar, there's a childish element to him. Now, what is this childish element? How would you describe this childish element about Yosef, according to the Midrash?
That he's vain and very into his looks?
Yes. Vain, he's into his looks, which is stemming from he has a very high sense of, you know, very an arrogant sense. There's a conceit, there's an arrogance, there's a narcissism, there's a profound sense of self-love that he's got to look perfect or, you know, at all times over here. All right, then, but not only he's not only 17 and a nar, a lad, and Rashi understands it as being childish in his presentation here, and he brings a bad report about the brothers. Okay, all right, Julie Bavakasha, let's read the Rashi.
Their evil report.
You put yourself on mute.
Right. Their evil report, whatever he saw wrong in his brothers, the sons of Leah, he reported to his father, that they used to eat flesh cut off from a living animal, that they treated the sons of the handmaids with contempt, calling them slaves, and that they were suspended of living in an immoral manner. With three such similar matters, he was therefore punished. In consequence of his having stated that they used to eat flesh cut off from a living animal, scripture states, and they slew a he-goat after they had sold him, and they did not eat his flesh whilst the animal was still living. And because of the slander which he related about them, that they called their brother slaves, Joseph was sold for a slave. And because he charged them with immorality, his master's wife cast her eyes upon him, etc.
Okay, so this is a very intriguing midrash, basically. But the bad report, according to the midrash, is what were the three crimes that he told his dad? He tattletaled on his dad about his brothers, or his half brothers, to be more accurate.
That they treated the sons of the handmaids with contempt, and calling them slaves, and that they were suspected of living in an immoral manner.
Right, so just to translate, that means they're involved in some sort of a sexual misdeed. The first one of the cut the flesh, to eat flesh cut off from a living animal, instead of slaughtering the animal and then eating its flesh, they just hack off, he claimed they would hack off a limb and then cook it and eat it. Now, the Midrash says, oh, because of these three claims, it said clearly in the Torah that they slaughtered a he-goat. They didn't, after they sold, and they didn't eat his flesh while the animal was still living. They showed that's not really true, or that wasn't their way. He called them, he said they called their brother slaves. He sold as a slave. He's charged him with immorality, and then his wife's, master's wife, cast her eyes on him and wanted to do immorality with him. So I don't want the mita keneged mita, the measure for measure, the punishment is a very intriguing thing. But just being very simply, he's reporting, he's putting at the reports that he is giving to their dad, according to the Midrash, are rather severe crimes. So I just want, all right, let's just, we're going to just hold on to that, and we're going to get to some questions here. Question number five, what self-image would Yosef have gotten from his father? Verse 3, Israel loved Yosef more than any of his brothers, other sons, since he was a child of his old age. He made Yosef a long collar for coat. How did Yaakov's behavior toward his son Yosef make him feel about himself? How did Yosef feel about himself? Sean. What's his self-image?
He thought he was better than everybody else, than all the brothers. He thought he was the best.
Exactly. And what's his proof?
Well, we got the special, like, jacket from his father.
Yeah. Well, two things. It's obviously, the Torah reports that his father loved him more than the other sons. Mm-hmm. So he's getting the benefit of the father's favoritism. And the coat is just the evidence, is So his sense of self is through the roof. You know, he's probably walking around the family as he's what? He's the prince. He's the prince of the family. Yaakov is the king. Yosef essentially has been identified as being the top dog. Now, is he the oldest son in the family? Is Yosef the oldest son? Who's the oldest son?
Reuven.
And then is he older than the second one, Shimon? Is he older than Shimon, number two? No. How about number three, Levi? Is he older than number three, Levi?
No.
How about number four, Yehuda? Is he older than number four, Yehuda? No. Reuven, Shimon, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zavul. I mean, basically, he's the oldest of Rachel, who was for the first number of years was infertile, and she had the child Yosef much later than the other. I think the first six brothers. I have to look it up, but basically, he's in the order of the children. He's like a middle child. But meanwhile, his sense of self has been quite expanded. And what word in the Torah highlights the immaturity of Yosef's self-image? We discussed this earlier. A quick one word.
Lad.
Lad, na'ar. He's a na'ar. He's immature. He has an immature sense of self. Now, in what way did maintaining his look and tattling on his brothers promote the immature self-image? How does that fit together?
Well, if you look apart and then you speak apart, then you're assumed to be apart.
Is he just simply a part? What are you saying about his brother?
Meaning playing a part, meaning playing a role, like playing a childish, immature role in the story or as a person.
Okay. So if he's, let's explore a little more. What is his immature self-image?
I mean, if he's tattling, I'm missing something, because if he's tattling, that's very immature if he's 17 years old.
Correct. How is he maintaining his superiority? He has two ways.
One is sharing.
Yeah.
I mean, he's sharing his dreams, or he's creating.
Even before sharing the dreams, we're going to get to the sharing the dreams.
With the coat?
Well, first of all, he walks around with his special coat. He's constantly, you know, his hair and his makeup is perfect. And he's bashing his brothers. So he presents himself as a superior. And what does he do to his brothers? Matthew? How does he portray his brothers?
As like jealous.
Well, they are jealous later on, but I'm saying earlier, before that, before the dreams. Scott?
Oh, he views them as slaves?
Well, he's not calling them. He's saying the other brothers, he's reporting that one set of brothers is calling the other brothers. But he's telling on them to dad. How does it all fit into his goal of being perceived as the superior one? It's a two-stepper. Step one, dress like you're the most special one in the family. Special coat, special hair, special makeup. And two, what do you say about the other brothers?
That they're obviously not as good as you.
They're losers. They're wicked people. They're evil people. You know what I'm saying? He's bringing an evil report. So he is raising himself up. And he's crushing them down in the eyes of his father. Okay, so that's what his that's the scene. Okay, now, so then he goes and tells his brothers the wonderful dreams. And in what way was the self-image contradicted by his brothers? He wants to feel like he's the great guy, and then he tells them about he's all excited to share with them these wonderful dreams.
They start, resent him, being like, now you want us to like bow down to you?
Right. They're what they're saying is they are, instead of honoring him, instead of praising him, what do they do? They degrade him. They say, do you want to be our king? Do you intend to rule over us? So instead of the love, the adoration, the tremendous praise that he was expecting, what did he get instead?
You know, anger and resentment.
Yeah, he got, right. He was hoping for, now why did he expect to get positive feedback, praise from his, when he shared his dreams?
He started to believe his own hype.
Exactly. In other words, his self-image, very like Mike Michael, was so fixed that he's the guy, he can't imagine that other people feel differently. And he's oblivious to the, he's oblivious to the other people's feelings. In what way is he exactly like Michael? There's an identical parallel here. Look at the dreams and the reaction. What is Michael Scott-esque here?
Well, Michael Scott basically failed the first couple of times, kept doing it. So just like Yosef, he kind of like failed in the reaction with the first dream, but he doubled down and told another dream.
Right. So really, he's really tripling down. First of all, right. He himself did not have any. Did he? In other words, a more mature person who's given a special coat from Dad would not wear that coat. Would not wear that coat. That you're just going to be taken to Pound Town. Okay. You know, if you want to be hated, that would be the way to do it. And then he doubles down again by what? Giving, you know, saying that, oh, these guys, when they're away from you, Dad, they're violating the basic laws of morality. They're acting like barbarians by ripping limbs off live animals and cooking them. They're demeaning each other by calling the brothers from the slave, you know, from Zilpah, Bilhah and Zilpah, slaves. And thirdly, they're involved in some sexual misconduct. So already, anybody, if you know you're going to be telling on your brother, you know your brother's not going to be digging you. But nevertheless, he brings everybody together. Guys, great news. Great news. Okay? Great news. I got this unbelievable dream. Okay? He tells them the dream. He's looking around. And what do? They say, do you want to be our king? Do you want to rule over us? He gets intense. He gets the wall of hate. Now, from that, even the fairly thick person would then do what if he gets another dream?
Keep it to himself.
What should he have done if he got this dream before? What should he have done if he got dream number two?
Kept it to himself.
Kept it to himself, or privately told his dad if he felt the dream had significance and meaning? Not call a family meeting and make this declaration, especially the continent. What does the continent of the dream say? He's standing there in the heavens and the sun, the moon, the stars are all bowing down to him. He's not another star. He's himself. So it seems to be the most egoistic dream you can possibly imagine. Okay. But so how much self-awareness does he have?
Not much.
None.
Zero. Zero. Zero amount of self-awareness. Okay. He's a Vahunar. He's 17 years old. He's very immature and he's very into himself. Now, obviously, he's a very bright person. So he's having a hard time. He may be very smart. But just like Michael, he cannot read the crowd. He doubles down. He triples down. He quadruples down. He's just looking for that validation, looking for the love. In all the wrong places, or the way that Scott said before, he's forcing it. Okay. Now I want to do a couple of scenarios, and I want to double back between the phase one, which was the hatred, and phase two was the jealousy. So let me just do some of the scenarios, because again, Scott's favorite part of the Shear, so I got to do it. So all right, scenario number one: Steve MJer is at a kiddish at MJE. He walks into a circle of attractive women. He starts dominating the conversation by sharing stories about himself. How can the parsha help Steve be more self-aware? Has anybody seen this before? I was at MJE this past Shabbos. You know, I see this kind of behavior all the time where a person sort of like inserts themselves into a circle of, you know, it's like a double insensitivity. One is that clearly a bunch of friends are having a conversation. Then the person inserts themselves in the circle. That's a little bit of a chutzpah. And then starts to like talk over or just sort of like dominate the conversation. Has anybody here witnessed such a phenomena? Have you seen this before? Yeah, Shane has given me the nod. Yes. Anybody else? Has anybody else seen this before?
Once or twice.
Yeah. So the bottom line is, so what would the parsha help Steve?
Just listen more, kind of just hang out.
Well, how does a parsha instruct him to be more self-aware? What ultimately happened to Yosef? How bad did the situation get with Yosef? What happens at the next part, the next chapter? What do the brothers do?
I mean, the worst. I mean, they sell him into slavery.
They sell him into slavery. Okay, so not only are they not buying what he's selling, okay, he creates such animosity and aggression. They sell him down the river. Now, obviously, that's not going to happen in Steve's case, but the point is that you want to get the love, the affection, and the attention of others, you're able to literally make the situation 10 times worse. And that's the story of the early years of Yosef. Okay? He thinks everybody's going to love him. So too the Steve. He's inserting himself in the circle of conversation with all these attractive women. You know, first of all, it's going to come off as weird and creepy. And then he's like with even less self-awareness. He then tries to dominate the conversation as if that's going to help. And it will not. That circle will quickly disband and everybody will suddenly go back to the kiddush table for some more hot dogs. Okay. Some more kugel. This guy will be left, solo in 5 seconds. Okay. Has anybody seen this at MJE? I saw this bash up. That's why I wrote that example. Okay. So that's number one. Number two, Rachel MJR is chatting on the phone with her friend Leah. Leah mentions that Stacy looks amazing in her new outfit from Bloomingdale's. Rachel finds herself immediately criticizing Stacy's look and sharing negative stories about her. Even after Leah defends Stacy, Rachel doubles down with more negative comments. How could Yosef's story educate Rachel in her lack of self-awareness and poor behavior? This happens all the time. So explain the dynamic. All right, Shane, explain the dynamic between Rachel, Leah, Stacy. What's going on in this hypothetical?
So Stacy gets a new outfit that looks fantastic on her. Rachel and Leah are talking about her when she's not there, which is a no-no in terms of Shmirat HaLashon.
Leah mentions it's a nice mitzvah to say, to praise somebody. So Leah's doing nothing wrong unless she knew in advance that Rachel hates Stacy, which she does not, let's say she does not know that. So that's a mitzvah to praise somebody behind somebody's back.
It doesn't necessarily say that Rachel hates her. I think Rachel is going to be jealous of her and is trying to put Stacy down by sharing negative things about her to boost herself up.
Exactly. So and why did she have now? But why does she have to double down and crush? Why does she have to crush Stacy, who's not on the call, obviously?
Because her self esteem is probably really low.
And therefore, what?
She feels better about herself when she puts somebody else down.
Right. She can't have anybody else being successful in her world. Just like Scott, Michael Scott can't have anybody funnier or cleverer than him in the office. He has to meet if somebody does a funny joke, or he has to immediately what? Do better than them or attack them. That's it. The person with the poor self-esteem, the immature self-esteem, has to attack the other person because they automatically feel threatened. So again, Yosef is unaware of the lack of his self-awareness is very little, and therefore does not realize. Then who else is clueless in the story? Who's clueless? Rachel, Leah, or Stacy?
I would say Stacy for sure, because she's not even involved and has no idea.
Right, so she's not aware of the conversation going, but who's psychologically clueless?
Leah.
Why?
Because she instead of, I guess, like trying to just move the conversation along, she defends Stacy, which allows, as it says, Rachel doubles down with more negative comments.
Well, first of all, is it defending your friend who gets bashed a bad thing or a good thing?
It's a good thing, but it's also not necessarily like trying to calm Rachel down with all the negativity.
Right. So if you see if you see that it's not going to be accepted and just going to bring more negative, then you should not do it. But obviously, Rachel also lacking self-awareness because the fact that Stacy looks amazing in her outfit, why it's got nothing to do with her. It doesn't mean that she's ugly. There could be more than one attractive person in the world. Okay, right? She has to be, mirror, mirror on the wall. Who's the fairest of them all? Only Rachel, okay? But people have these feelings. This is very normal feelings. All right. Scenario number three. This has happened to me over many times. Stan Amgier has been selected to receive the Student Recognition Award at MG. Joe Amgier calls Rabbi Wilds. They've also called me before. To complain about Stan's selection. Joe says, I have done so much more for the community. I attend so many more classes than Stan. Why was I not selected? How could Joseph's story educate Stan in his lack of self-awareness and poor behavior?
That he doesn't have to be the center of attention and other people can be... have maybe earned it and should be rewarded.
Yes. Now the truth is, the brothers, who's all, in other words, we're right now focusing on the brothers being the Yosef being immature from not noticing it. But what about the brothers? Are they not at fault here also?
No, they essentially definitely the brothers are like the guy who calls up, like the Stan, or the guy, the Joe, who calls up and says, "Why wasn't he recognized?"
There, in other words, it's a here's the reason. Here's the perfect storm. You have both parties are immature. You have Yosef, who's so into himself, so that he's the best, and by putting down the others, he is the king of the family, the prince of the family. But the brothers are also being immature because they should say, well, look, you're basically being a teenage baby, and okay, and they should not have to be aggressive toward him. You know what I'm saying? As Sean just said, yeah, Stan might be wrong to gloat. Let's say Stan was gloating. Yeah. Oh, by the way, I hope you'll be able to make the upcoming MG dinner. Well, I will be receiving the. A student recognition award, in order if they're doing the humble brag, the not so humble brag, and making the other people feel like, you know, the other people are also immature. Nor is it really, all the parties are immature. In other words, Dan's immature to, let's assume he's, bragging about it. Let's assume that's the case, like Yosef. And Joe, is like the brothers, is also complaining about it and trying to put him down, trying to counterattack. You know what I'm saying? You're acting like the loved one? No, we hate your guts. Oh, you're trying to be a king? You're a megalomaniac? You're an egomaniac? So the whole situation is a disaster. Okay, so with that introduction, now I'm going to go back to the question we raised before. Pull back up. This is a little bit of a tougher question. A little bit tougher. Okay, let me get my little annotate option here. Okay, so right now, the first dream, they hated him even more, okay? Second time, very jealous. Well, what's the difference? Why hatred than jealousy?
Because you got the coat later, right? They were jealous of the coat.
No, the coat doesn't say the reaction to the coat. Yosef loves his brothers more than any other. Because saying that since he was a child of old age, made Yosef call for coat. That's first. When they realized they hated him first. And they couldn't talk to him.
Because in the first scenario, the father was upset with him. And he was upset. The father had said, and the brothers and the mother were all like in the same boat against him. And in the second one, maybe the brothers felt that, there was something to his dreams because his father suspended judgment.
So why is that jealousy, not hatred?
Because maybe they sense that there was something to his dreams and they wish they would have had such dreams.
Excellent thought, Julie. The jealousy is when somebody else has some object or quality that you want. When they heard the second dream, they had a sinking feeling. First of all, the fathers repudiated, but they weren't buying it. I don't know why I can't see you guys right now. Okay, so the thing is that as Julie pointed out, the first time, what is the emotion of hatred? Let's start with hatred. They hated him first. They hated him because they loved him more than the rest, and they couldn't talk to him peaceably. Then dream number one with the sheaves, they hated him even more, right? Then dream number two, the hatred is gone. Now they go on to full on jealousy. Let's understand that progression, the three stepper. Who can take us through that process? The journey from hatred. What do you think? How do you explain? Tell me, take us through the journey here from hatred, from the coat, from the love. Well, let's say
first comes the first dream.
No, before
then the coat.
No, they know. For no, it's coat, dream, dream. And after the coat, when his brothers realized that their father loved him more than all the rest, they began to hate him. They could not even say a peaceful word to him. That was step one. Then after the dream with the sheaves, they said, because of his dreams and his words, going back to when he talked bad about them, they hated him even more. That's step two. Then step three was after the
suspension of judgment.
Then they were jealous with him. Now, his father was Vishamar to Devar. He had suspended judgment, or he wanted to see what was going to go on. But, and as Julie pointed out, that's because they were jealous to the fact that there may be a reality to what he's not dreaming nonsense. What is, but what's the, what's step one, step two, step three? Take me through the steps here. Who would like to take a shot at it? What's the hatred? Let's start off with the easy one. Let's break it down. Why they hate him? Why they hate him? Because his father loves him more. Let's start with the most basic thing. Step one. Why is that?
He gets this awesome jacket.
They don't mention the jacket. It's the jacket reveal to them that their father loved them more. So that explain that a little more. Who can unpack that a little more?
He didn't get a jacket for everyone.
He did not get a jacket for everyone. It's like, for example, Sunday night is the first night of Hanukkah. Imagine your parents come home and they give gift to your siblings and you get nothing. Okay? How will you feel?
Jealous and hatred.
You're just going right to the third step. Hatred, right, and jealousy. Just right on in. Okay. Okay. You'll be jealous of the gifts and hatred of that. Okay. But what is the hatred stemming from? Come on, guys.
There's a feeling of, well, going to your example with the Hanukkah presents, there's a feeling of rejection. That my parents reject me as one of their kids. They prefer the other kids. And so that those deeper feelings turn into an outer feeling of hate, like hating those that are getting the attention, hating those that are getting the presents, because I feel rejected by my parents.
Right, and I should, because the assumption is that if you have hatred toward him because he is getting this love, the other brothers feel that they should be getting the love. And they're feeling that the fact that Yaakov has so publicly showed favoritism to Yosef was basically very painful. So they hate him because they view him as the obstacle of them getting the love that they deserve. Okay? And then, but then it's interesting. But they don't mention the fact about the reports yet. After the dream, it says he hated him because of his dreams and his words. They hated him even more. Why does the dream make it worse? Why did the dream make the hatred worse? Because how can you make it worse?
Because it's literally saying that, like, not only does, you know, their father love him more than them, but now he's having these dreams saying that they're going to be bowing down to him.
Right. In other words, not only do you're getting the love, you're also presenting that we are basically slaves to you. We're the losers. You know, we're now in a very low status. So they hate him. In other words, you're putting us down. One thing is not to get the love. That's terrible. Then on top of that, you're making us look bad. We're bowing to you. Like you're the king. And then combined with the reports that he had reported on them, he tattled on them that they're doing bad things when their dad's away. They hate him even more. Then we have the second dream of the moon, the stars, moon, the sun, the stars is bowing down to Yosef. They're jealous because they see the way their father reacted. What kind of dream did you have? You want me, your mother, and your brothers to come and bow down to you, to the ground? Now is that a full repudiation of the dream? So it's repudiation. What did Yaakov try to do in that public criticism of Yosef?
I mean, he tried to agree with his sons, like, you shouldn't be having dreams like that, that, you know, that will all bow to you.
I didn't make the dream. This is what pops into my head. Norris is a weird, you know. So he said, you know, what the criticism could be now? Are they buying the criticism? Why didn't they say? Look, why didn't they say? See, Dad thinks you're an idiot. Dad thinks that you're an egomaniac.
Well,
why didn't they go
their dad to read him the, you know, to read him the Riot Act? You know what I mean?
So, but in other words, why was Yaakov not successful? Oh, you want me to bow down to you? So he's obviously scolding him. He's repudiating. So why didn't he say? Why did that now make the brothers feel good? See, Dad thinks that brother Yosef is an egomaniac. Why didn't that? Why? In fact, the hatred then now transmorphed into jealousy. In a certain sense, the situation got worse. Why is that? What do you say, guys?
They were expecting some harsh punishment and some of that love to go their way.
So you're saying that you're saying that he did his father did not go far enough.
They wanted him to be like, you know, taken down like a peg or two.
So was he taken down at all?
No, he wasn't.
I mean, he does say, he says his father scolded him and he said, "What kind of dream do you have? You want me and your mother, your mother and your brothers to come and prostrate ourselves to the ground to you? Is that taking down a peg?"
I mean, I think they just wanted it to be go further than that. Maybe like take the coat back or something.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's good. That's good. So it might be, maybe he was taking down a singular peg, but it wasn't an absolute repudiation. He didn't say, Yosef, what you're dreaming is absolute and complete nonsense. What you're doing is giving expression to some egotistical megalomaniac vision of yourself. You need help. That would have made a difference. You know what I'm saying? But the fact that he just did a one little, "Oh, you want us to bow down to you?" That felt a little, as Scott saying, that felt a little light. If he would have like taken the coat back, you know what I mean? That would have been much more meaningful. And that would have been a further putting in, let's call it what you call a putting back into place. They didn't really feel that he put him in. What he got was a light slap of the wrist, not a firm reduction of rank. Okay. Is that what you're saying, Scott?
Yeah.
So as such, they detected in this father, because they knew this father liked him a whole lot and valued him. They were hardly convinced that the father didn't believe that the dream might have some real what? Some real value to it. They sensed that the dad, who is not just any dad, but is Yaakov, who is a prophet, the fact that he gave such a weak repudiation indicates that, there's a problem. There may be a reality to this. And as such, they became jealous that, oh my gosh, we realized that dad really views him as being essentially the heir apparent. He's going to be the king of the family. And we are going to be end up as what? His slaves. That's their fears. Okay. So that, of course, now they may have, and now in their rationalization, we discussed about this in classes past, they rationalize that really, dad doesn't realize that the family's being taken over by a megalomaniac, and therefore we have the right to sell them into slavery. Of course, that works out to be a false rationalization. But the real thing is that they could not tolerate the fact that dad is selecting this painfully conceited, stuck-up, you know, self-absorbed, smarty pants of a younger brother. That was just absolutely painful to them. And they felt, now, Yosef was wrong for acting in this way of promoting this amount of aggression. Force, in other words, and he's forcing. You guys should accept it. In other words, he's no different than Michael Scott. Michael Scott is forcing that everybody should accept him as being clever and funny and witty. What is Yosef accept? For, what is Yosef forcing them? What is Yosef forcing the brothers to do?
Believe his dreams.
And which means what?
That he's literally everything that they believe, or that he believes, that like he's better than them.
Not only is he better than them, that he's really, and he will be what?
Their king, their ruler.
Yeah, he's taken over. And why do you have a problem with that? You should accept it. Yeah, that, so his forcing his authority upon them brought out the most extreme reaction, which is basically to sell him to Egypt. Or actually, initially, it was actually to kill him. They rationalized it as, oh, because this guy's a big threat to the family.
Well, they sold him and faked his death.
Well, that was plan two. Plan one was to put him in a pit and let him die out of starvation. And Judah, Yehuda said, you'll see later on the parsha, says, what ma betza, what profit is having him just die in the pit? We should sell him for some cash. They sell him for 20 pieces of silver. The Medrash says they bought shoes. Anyway, so that's the deal. So there are a lot of important lessons here to be talking. Number one is the forcing relationships. All of us want the approval of others. Even, you know, obviously Michael Scott is a character of an extreme personality, but oftentimes we want people's approval. So therefore we push it. Either we want them to think we're funny, we push the jokes. That's the dad joke, the dad joke. What is a dad joke? Why does dads make the lame jokes to the kids? What really is he really want?
He wants the love of the kids.
He wants to love the kids. He wants the kids to think that he's cool. He wants them to think that he's funny. And he's forcing the relationship. Don't force it. Or, you know, in the case that we example of, whether it be Steve that's trying to force people who, attractive women to be enthralled by his wonderful stories, okay? Let a relationship happen organically, naturally, not try to force it. Or, Rachel and Leah don't, you know, whatever. Or Stan, all these different people trying to force certain situations. Just be chill. Allow relationships to happen. Be aware of, are people buying what you're selling? And if they're not, do not double down. Because you double down, it might be a disaster. Yosef's, of course, is the most extreme disaster. But we all are, you know, everybody does this from time to time. You know what I mean? We want the love, the approval, the attention of somebody else. And we're not picking up the clues. And we double down and we just irritate them more. It's certainly true with parents and kids and parents, siblings, friends, male and female, every permutation. The boss, anybody seen this? If there's one person who's like constantly complimenting or talking to the boss in a way to try to endear themselves to the boss. Have you ever seen that before? Sean is giving the big, yes. They're forcing the relationship. They're trying to, would you be my mentor? Your insights have been so helpful. You know, otherwise known in Yiddish as kishin tuchus. You know what I mean? Trying to really force the relationship when it's not there, instead of letting it be organic. Okay, so this is, of course, the Chumash tells you an extreme sad tale of Yosef being psychologically unaware of his own egotistical feelings, his feelings of arrogance, and he was unaware, and his need to force the relationship upon the brothers. They should accept my greatness. How come they're not accepting my, they should, after I gave my, after I shared the story of their dreams, I should have got, he was expecting what? A round of applause. And he got taken to Pound Town. What, you want us to be his king? You want us to bow down to us? You know what I mean? He got nothing but derision. That's what, by the way, that's just, that's that, by the way, that's what, if you're gonna, if you get tremendously negative feedback from something, you know you have been emotionally blind, because you don't ever want to have a situation result in extreme negative feedback. So if it happens, that means that's a poker tell that you have been emotionally blind in dealing with this particular person. Just that's a clear practical advice from the Parsha. Because typically you're not going to do anything and you get extreme reactions like that. All right, guys. Any questions?
I have one.
Good.
Is the first dream with the sheaves of wheat any type of foretelling of the famine?
So it's interesting. Rabbi Soloveitchik has a whole explanation of the two dreams. That the hearers of the brothers, even though that Yosef was wrong to not be psychologically sensitive to them, but basically what the dreams, which had a prophetic character to, was basically saying, we're living here in Canaan, and we believe our life will always be the way it is. We're going to be humble shepherds. You know what I mean? We're going to be, you know, that's our future is herdsmen. Okay. But the reality is the future is we're going to be going to the land of Mitzrayim and be involved in farming. I mean, a new industry. You know what I'm saying? We're going to go from herders of animals to a new economic world. Then you have the second one, which is the sun, the sky, the stars, the sun, the moon, the stars reflects a spiritual awareness. There's going to be a transition where, you know, the spiritual reality of us currently living as a family in Canaan, we're going to ultimately going to be the promise of that we're going to be as numerous as the stars and become a nation and ultimately get the Torah was being foreshadowed in those two kinds of dreams. So dream one, change of economic reality, and that the Torah and the Judaism has to be transplanted to that world. And number two is there's going to be a new spiritual destiny, which is going to happen in their journey to Egypt and ultimately back to Mount Sinai. So it's sort of foreshadowing them that there's going to be a radical new experience. I think on Sepharia they might have he put it in a speech to the Mizrahi movement, which is the religious Zionists of America. And he talked about the two dreams being two visions of the future. And ultimately, yeah, Yosef was immature, but the brothers should have been a little more understanding that they're dealing with a little, you know, teenage brother. In other words, what was their error? Which Reuven says later on in the Parsha, which is...
talk to him?
No, he's immature, but he's also 17. Does anybody here want to be judged based upon your behavior and attitudes of age 17? I don't think so. Okay. And they got so offended and so shaken and so emotional about it. Yosef is coming from a spirit of his immaturity. And they did not take that into consideration. And Reuven, the oldest brother, says, and he was crying out to us. This is later on in Egypt. And he was just a nar, and he's just a boy. Now they didn't take into consideration, like, yeah, is he being egotistical? Yes. Is he conceited? Yes. Does he sound megalomaniac? Yeah. Okay. If he's 40 years old, that's one thing. He's 17. You gotta cut the kid a flack. They did not. They were emotional. They themselves had a problem. So they were not be able to be objective judges of the situation.
How old was Reuven at the time?
So he's about, mid to late 20s. So you got a little more, you gotta be more mature, you know?
Right.
17 is high school. Not even a senior. That's a junior in high school. Okay. Yeah, that is not the high, that is not a high point in emotional maturity. And Chazal, that we read earlier, is that he was more childish in his behavior. He was a little more immature. Okay, maybe because he's being coddled by his father. He's told that he's being beloved. His mother is dead, so maybe the father is treating him in a certain way that's actually making him a little more immature. So you have all kinds of circumstances here. So, all right, there's a lot of lessons to glean from that. Obviously, coming out to Hanukkah, clearly from the Parsha, the most basic thing is, do not show favoritism. You have nieces and nephews, you give them a present, even Stephen. Okay, same basic price point. Don't give one kid a big expensive present, and another one a little dinky cheap present. Okay, do not do that. Basic Hanukkah rules, 101. Hanukkah gift giving 101. All right, guys, have a great night. Catch you guys tomorrow. We're gonna Rabbi, be on.
Rabbi, one more question.
It's you.
If Yosef wasn't thrown into the pit and sold to the slaves and like everything else that happened to put him in the second in command into Egypt, would he have wound up in that position anyway?
I don't know how we could know that.
I guess the point I'm trying to say is like everything had to happen the way it happened in order for him to wind up in that position.
Well, that's what he says to them. You know, God, you tried to do evil to me, but God brought a great salvation to everybody and saved a great amount of people by me ending up here. That's how he interprets this as being the road of the road of the providence of the Hashkacha. But there's another phrase about divine providence. Harbe shluchim lemakom. God has many messengers. Or he can get the job done, not limited one way. Harbe shluchim lemakom. God has many ways of getting the job done. He doesn't just have one play in the playbook. So I don't know. But I don't want to speculate what would have, you know, that it's one of those, you know, alternate. Can we create an alternate DVD ending to the story of Yosef? We could, but that would, you know, I don't know. It'd be speculation. It could be a lot of fun. All right, guys. Have a great night.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rabbi.